This episode is brought to you by Rock in Rio Lisboa, the sister event to Brazil's iconic music festival Rock in Rio. The Portuguese leg of the event is set to celebrate its 20th anniversary with one of its biggest editions yet, and over 80,000 attendees across its 4 days, of which some of them could be you. Taking place over 2 weekends this June, some of music's biggest names will be taking to the stage in Lisbon. We're talking Ed Sheeran, we're talking Doja Cat, even the Jonas Brothers are getting in on the action. And with each day specially curated by genre, there's literally something for everyone. I went to the town in Rio last year, which is curated by the same people as Rock in Rio, and it was, I'm going to say, one of the wildest festivals I've ever been to. This year's Rock in Rio Lisboa takes place on the 15th, 16th, 22nd and 23rd of June, and tickets can be purchased now via their website, rockinriolisboa.pt. Hello and welcome to the newest episode of Before They Knew Better with DIY Magazine. My name is Lisa Wright and today we've got a bit of a special one for you. This episode, the second of our second season, was recorded live last month at the Social in Soho with our very special guest, Jonathan Higgs of Everything. Of course, by this point, I would say part of the UK indie fabric. They are 7 albums in. Their last one just released, Mountain Head, is a cracker. And Jonathan had, I'm going to say, probably the most mad tales from his childhood of anyone that we've had in now 14 episodes of this podcast. Jonathan grew up in a small village, and like a lot of kids who grew up in small places, there was very little to do except, it seems, try and make your own bombs. So Jonathan Higgs spent a very entertaining evening with us at the Social, shout out to the Social, last month, where we asked him to bring in, as we do with everyone on Before They Knew Better, an object, a song, a photo from his younger days. He is the first person also to have brought in a song of their own creation. And what a song it is. Listeners, that is a treat that you have coming up. So without further ado, a Sunday in March with Jonathan Higgs of Everything, and us, Before They Knew Better with DIY Magazine. So, I mean, like, I would say that Everything are a band sort of like largely associated with very forward thinking attitudes, technology, all this kind of stuff. Whereas we are asking you today to look backwards. Is there ever a part, would you say that you have like an element of nostalgia to you?
Increasingly so, yeah.
Okay, good for you. Otherwise, this could go quite badly. I was looking, and I think, like, you're known as a Manchester band, but actually grew up in Northumberland.
That's right.
In a little village.
Yep.
Tell us about, like, what was the place that you grew up like? What was it like sort of being in presumably a place with not huge access to, like, venues and stuff?
No, there's no venues. So it's a tiny little village. Like 100 people, maybe probably less actually. There was a village hall, which was right next to my house. 3 pubs and nice. A church, and lots of fields and stuff. So it was very much outdoors kind of childhood.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a TV, so
through like a sort of they're going to be book people.
Yeah, I think they just didn't want to have one and. We didn't really know any different. I mean, our friends down the road did, so we would see things, but we didn't have it as part of our life. Like, it wasn't daily. We'd watch telly.
Were you jealous about that? Like, would you go
sometimes.
To school and, like, be like, oh, why do they get to watch Neighbours?
Well, Neighbours was one of those ones that actually did kind of creep in because it was so big. So we knew about when Todd got run over.
Oh my God.
We knew
Harold.
I actually saw that episode and it really deeply affected me. To the point where I feel like I might have even referenced it in a song, actually.
No.
Yeah, I think I might have. It's funny, I didn't even think of that. We knew about, you know, Bouncer. We knew about the big stuff that happened.
The big stars. Okay.
But yeah, there was lots of playing outside, lots of destroying things. That seemed to be a big...
Okay. What was your favourite method of destruction?
We would get a big stick each, or if as time went on, I actually got a hold of like quite a big metal pole. and we would go into the forest and find dead trees and just smash the branches off them and try and like smash the trees themselves down. But we did the whole thing with a kind of like we would imagine that they were enemies and that there was like armies coming towards us. So we would like be like shouting to each other in American accents to kind of like get down and do this and like come over here and like smash this tree.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I can't believe that you managed to find loads of friends that also wanted to do that with you.
There were primarily two guys, Ash and Jono, who lived down the road, and we started a band when we were like 13.
Okay. Did it have anything to do with the wild violence?
It was kind of like a continuation of that relationship that we had of creativity, I suppose you could say. And it was sort of destructive, which was kind of an element of the band, but... the village hall that was right next to my house is where we would rehearse.
Right.
But obviously it was like not exactly made for a rock band, so it just sounded really terrible and everyone in the whole village could hear it because it just came straight out of the windows and through the walls. Just a really annoying, like terrible Nirvana covers and stuff that we would do.
Was that the sort of village? Because like my memories of that sort of vibe was like you would go, maybe it would be like brownies on a Monday and then a band rehearsing on a thing, and maybe you go and do your first like school play there or something like that. Like, was that the place where you kind of cut your teeth?
It was, but nothing would ever happen on any of the days.
Right.
maybe there was a youth club, but I think I went to it once and there was like two people there. And
nice.
There wasn't enough people there to do anything, really.
Okay, it's because you were all out smashing the trees up.
Yeah.
And no regrets.
Oh yeah, we used to smash loads of stuff. We used to make quite a lot of bombs. My brother made some napalm. So you just get like a pot noodle pot of petrol, because my dad had loads of petrol in the shed that was full of mummified cats, incidentally.
Sorry.
Yeah, so my dad collects like skulls and dead animals in different
ways.
So there were several mummified cats in the shed. Anyway, he had a big barrel of petrol in there, and my brother filled up this pot noodle pot with petrol, and we found this old sofa in the stream that was mostly polystyrene, and then we just broke up all the polystyrene and slowly melted it into this pot noodle pot, and it was like a whole sofa into a pot noodle pot. So this petrol was like really, really potent, like goop. And then we just spread it all over a tree and set fire to it. And he said that was napalm.
What happened? Did it just explode?
It burnt for ages. No, it didn't explode. It just burnt for ages and ages. That's what it does, unfortunately.
Did you get arrested?
No, there's no... So the village is right on the border between Northumberland and Cumbria. Mm. Right on the border. Like, it's a river that goes past the house, which is why I sang I'm at the border. Because I was in that garden shed I'm talking about with the stream. And I was literally at the border between the two places. And I was like, what am I going to sing? I was like, well, here I am. And so it just meant, all that really meant in reality was that the Cumbrian police never bothered to police it. And neither did they. Neither did Northumberland police. Because this village was right, just basically no man's land in the borders. And the whole area is called the borders anyway, because it's the place between Scotland and England, so it's like doubly unpoliced, and it always has been.
Wow.
So that was good.
All right. I feel like this is like, you know, when you watch those programs about like, this is how you avoid crimes, and all I think is like, all you're doing is teaching people how to do those crimes.
We made a pretty good pipe bomb as well, if you want to know how to do that.
Okay, so you're painting an image of quite a, I'm going to say, wild youth here.
Yeah, I think so.
Were you quite a sort of like a bit of a wild card as a kid?
I think we all were. I think that's kind of the mentality you have to have when you live in a place like that. So yeah, we didn't think it was that strange, but when I tell these stories, it does sound a bit more wild than I realised.
Also, I feel like we can't go past fridge full of skulls without going into that slightly. So your dad had a fridge full of dead animals and a house full of skulls?
The freezer, yeah, was...
Sorry.
Was it doesn't... Well, you don't want a fridge full of it. So the freezer would often have roadkill in the freezer because he would take their skulls, and sometimes he didn't always get round to it, so there might be something at the bottom that was he never took the head off. But people would bring roadkill to the house because they knew that he collected skulls. And so there was one time there was a deer just left in the yard, like a full-ass deer, just sort of dead. And then he would go out and he'd cut its head off. And then he had all these different ways to get the flesh from the head. So don't moan.
It's nature, man. Deal with it.
The main one was boiling it, but he said that wasn't good because it gets rid of the ligaments that keep the teeth attached or something like this. So the genuinely best one was to keep them in the crypt, which was in the garden, but that takes ages. So he got these beetles from, I think he said, North Africa that eat flesh. And that did work for a little while.
Oh, sorry. And you just set them on the animals?
No, well, you put the skull into their box and then they would eat the flesh. But unfortunately, they escaped into the shed. So it didn't last very long, that technique, because all the flesh-eating bugs escaped into the shed.
There's so much to unpack here. They just escaped, and you didn't wake up and be like, "Oh, I've got a finger missing."
Well, it's down the bottom of the garden. Like it wasn't gonna eat us while we were alive. I think they eat dead flesh, like a maggot.
Right. Okay. Thank you for specifying. And. Did that? So he was a taxidermist?
Oh, yeah, he did. He tried his hand at taxidermy. He wasn't very good at it, but he would. I don't even know what he is exactly.
A weird man.
He's a hobbyist with a sort of biological sort of bent. So the house would be full of these skulls, but it wasn't just that. It would be like a kind of museum. The house was like a museum, so all the drawers were full of fossils and sort of anthropological stuff, you know, stuff from different cultures. So it was just like loads of curiosity, but with this like hardcore biological approach, where you would dissect rats on the kitchen table and stuff. And when I did my GCSEs, I said I wanted to take photos of a brain. So he went with me to the butcher and he was like, "Can we have a pig's head?" And we took it home and sawed the top of its skull out and took the brain out. And yeah. It didn't seem that weird. I still don't think it's that weird.
No, I mean, like, it's not... It's very committed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He has hobbies, and he gets really into them. Like, he was a stargazer for a bit, or he got really into to Halley's Comet when it came round. Mm. So he took these amazing pictures of it, like, passing over, and, like, proper professional stuff. And then it was just like, yeah... Done never that. Mentions it again. Perfect. You know, and you'll do that with everything, but the thing with animals is always been there.
Is that something where as a kid you thought that was cool, or you were like, "Oh, Dad, you're so embarrassing, why is there another deer on my lawn?"
No, we always I mean, it was there before I had embarrassment, so it didn't factor in until I got friends. And if they until I got embarrassed friends, so if they were embarrassed, then I'd just be like, don't come around my house then.
Yeah, if you don't want to see the half they all thought it was cool skull, don't come around my house, man.
People think those kind of things are cool.
Yeah,
anyway.
It was quite good. Did you ever like have a foray into that sort of world? Like what's the weirdest animal that you've like, I don't know, chopped up, put into a beetle cage? All of these I've never asked that question before.
No. I mean, not really. It's always been it interests me, but I'm not to the point where I would do it. But I think it does get into the stuff I do, definitely. I think that being that sort of aware of the line between life and death, and like the reality of chopping up an animal, probably did affect my view in some way. Definitely something about it infects just the way I view that kind of thing. I guess if you worked in a morgue or something, you know, or your parents were surgeons or something, you would maybe it would rub off.
Yeah, I think
being acutely aware of that stuff, but also, on the other hand, I guess, seeing a parent be, like, really interested in things and, like, follow their passions and, like, have proper hobbies. Like, that's the sort of stuff that I think is a great example where then presumably that made you kind of go, like, oh, okay, I really love making music. I really love
it meant that I just,
doing...
if I wanted to do something, I thought that I probably could do it. And I still have that mentality now when I'm like, I bet I could do that.
Yeah.
And then I try and do it. And, yeah, I fall short sometimes. And sometimes I don't. And it's like, that's because I gave it a shot, probably. And it probably comes from my dad, yeah.
Yeah. What were you... So, you're in Northumberland, destroying the woods, creating fake army battles.
Yeah.
At what point did music and art and those sort of things come into your life?
Well, I was always making art. I was drawing and painting and sculpting, and I would paint miniatures. And I'd make my own miniatures with, like, cringy names.
Like, and, what, please?
There was a whole tribe of them that were called the Space Punks. But it was with an X. And they all had Mohicans on top of their helmets.
Yes.
Yeah, but I would get these dinosaurs out of, like, Weetos and chop this, like, the spine off the Spinosaurus and stick it onto these Space Marines and stuff like this. So there was, I never really played by the rules of... the Warhammer rules. In fact, I never played a game of the game, Warhammer, whatever it's called. I just got the miniatures and made them my own kind of thing.
Would you play games with them that were your own games?
No. No, they were just purely for the art of it, you know, how they looked. And
still got the Space Punks?
Yeah, still got them. Nice. I nearly brought them today, but I couldn't go through with it.
It's okay. We've got plenty of treats that Jonathan has brought today. Do not worry. Were you, like, in your head, were you the leader of the Space Punks?
No, not really. Okay. I was just an observer.
Okay. Just watching them go about their day. That's good.
Yeah.
So then, you've got to ask. The boys that you were in the woods with were your first bandmates?
Yeah, so my brother played the bass. I played the trumpet. All the kids in the family, I've got three siblings, we all played instruments, and I played the trumpet. And then my brother played the piano, but then he started to play the bass when he was a bit older. And I would sometimes pick it up and try and learn, like, Smashing Pumpkins bass lines and stuff. And then my two friends, Ash and Jono, their dad lost his job, but he got a big payout. And he said, what do you guys want with this money? And Jono said, a drum kit. And Ash said, a guitar. And we were like, hang on. If I get my brother's bass, and we just discovered Nirvana, we were like, this is all you need, apparently, to start a band. So we just did. Just like the day his guitar arrived kind of thing.
Do you remember, like, the feeling of kind of playing with other people for the first time?
Yeah, it was terrible. I mean, it was exciting, but we knew the sound we were making was awful. But that's, you know, it's got to be. It'd be great.
Yeah.
It'd be terrible if it was good.
Would you do, like, sort of, so there's the Village Hall, obviously, the hub of, what was the exact town?
The what?
The exact town.
It's a village called Gilsland.
Gilsland.
It's right on the Roman wall, so there's lots of Roman stuff there that tourists
see. Okay, yeah, I was actually looking something up, and it's, like, got a big Hadrian's Wall sort of tourism thing. Fun for people that want to go to Gilsland.
Yep.
So would you, like, if there's no sort of music things nearby, like, what's the way that a kid from Gilsland goes about trying to, like, get into music?
Well, we had older siblings.
Yeah.
So most of it sort of filtered in through them. I mean, where we went to school was quite far away in Hexham. And obviously, there was, like, a record shop there and stuff. And we had the radio. We had Atlantic 252.
I've heard of the radio, yes.
There was just the old ways of doing it. We had one tape we'd listen to a million times, and then one CD, and go from there.
Can you remember, like, the first thing that was, like, a really formative band for you?
I definitely remember the Beatles being something that I would listen to, of, you know, of my own accord. Like, it wasn't just on. It was like, I'm going to go and put it on. Simon and Garfunkel. My parents had loads of records.
Mm-hmm.
Bonzo Dogs, Doodah Band, which is obviously really ridiculous, so the kids really like it. And that was all the stuff before we got the American things. And as soon as that happened, we were like, right, not looking back kind of thing. I'm not playing the trumpet anymore, that's for sure.
Why was it? I mean, like, I guess everyone sort of gets, like, funneled into an instrument at school, but, like, did you love the trumpet?
Didn't really. I kind of always knew it was kind of lame, but I just sort of went with it. And I think it probably taught me some stuff. And, you know, I don't regret playing the trumpet, but I always knew this was not, like, I didn't really want to do it.
Not the one for you.
No.
Not until you discover the power of rock and roll bands.
Exactly, yeah.
Exactly. So we've asked Jonathan to bring in a song, an object, and a photo. And we have this photo of... how old are you in this beautiful picture? With some really good sideburns. Like, they are low. They are going, like, down to the chin.
I might be 16, because I had really long hair when I was 15, and this is after that. So, yeah, I could even be 16 or 17, maybe.
Okay. Can you remember, like, why was it that this particular picture felt like a sort of formative
time?
Well,
I've got loads and loads of photos of myself, but I couldn't get any in time. So I asked my friend Jono, what have you got? And this is me walking into Ash and Jono's house, actually. I don't know why my hand's so filthy like that.
Because you've been whacking the fucking trees.
No, that was... We probably were still doing some of that by this point, but... that thing around my wrist, I think it was like some hospital thing I had on. I seem to remember I wore it for like a couple of years. It was like this plastic thing. But yeah, there's a...
As in because you've been in hospital?
Yeah, I guess I have, but I honestly don't know why.
Like a punk injury?
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, this would have been a typical night with the flash. going round to theirs, yeah.
This is in Ash or Jono of Ash
brothers.
And Jono fame.
They're both brothers, yeah.
House, okay. What would you be doing with your time at this age?
Probably drugs.
Fair. Now that you mention it, your pupils are quite white in the photo.
You say that, but it was very difficult to get actual drugs in a place like that. So we would improvise quite a lot. We would smoke peanut shells. We would smoke banana skins. So you like cook the banana skins in the oven first, and then you scrape it out and smoke it. None of it got you very high. Then very occasionally we'd get some actual drugs, but that was one of the main focuses of the time.
I mean, like, there's a through line of, like, making your own bombs,
yeah.
Making your own drugs.
Yeah, there is. You just got to make do in the countryside.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a real creativity to your sort of waywardness as a youth. What, when you smoke a peanut shell, what's that like?
It's just so horrible, yeah.
Does it do it, like... Just no, very, very toxic.
I think a lot of it,
crunchy.
Like, you just, because you've inhaled low smoke, you get like a head rush because you're not meant to do that. And that was like, oh yeah, I'm getting high.
Right.
Which is what people do now with certain things. It's just like they confuse the two. But it was fun as well. So their eldest brother, Krilly, who was a bit of a ledge, I remember him making a peanut joint that was literally like an A4 piece of paper. It wasn't actually A4 paper, but it was that big. It was so stupid and like thick, like I don't even know what's that size really.
Don't make that my awkwardness.
sorry, it was huge.
It was a large paper joint, which presumably was
peanut shells. Yeah, I mean, he didn't get very far through. I've just remembered something actually. We used to get these big packets of Joss sticks. Like 500 at a time.
Like a Joss stick?
No, we would light them all, and then we'd put them in the room, and we would try and stay in the room for as long as we could. But one of the things, one of the ways around it that we devised was, do you remember you get these like plastic, big long plastic tubes that are kind of corrugated, and you would whirl them round, and they go, yay. So we'd put one of those outside the door, and then we'd all take turns like breathing air. from inside this like joss stick room. God
that's
knows
like
why we did that.
That's like the most middle class hot box that I've ever had.
We weren't trying to even get high. That was just for fun. But that was definitely younger than that picture when we were doing that.
Okay, yeah. By this point, you'd graduated onto the peanuts, at least. So I was reading that during this time, maybe slightly after, you made a film. Man Alone?
Yeah.
Is that circa 17-year-old John?
I was like 21.
Oh, okay. I would still like to know about this, though. Purely because, by the sounds of it, I mean... You're better to describe this, obviously, but a sort of 2-hour odyssey of film and music and multiple characters and like, it sounds groundbreaking.
it broke some ground, yeah. It's definitely a thing. I've still got it. I actually watched it just a few weeks ago because I know people are eager to see it, and I was thinking, I could put this out, and I watched it, and I was like, no. So it's a musical. It's about 2.25 hours. The groans already. So it's like it's about this guy who, he has this sort of rivalry with this other guy because he wants him to join the army or something. Anyway, there's these two guys that hate each other, and one of them sort of blows a blow dart into the hero's arm. Mason Coop is the hero, and. And when he gets done with this dart, like these spots appear on his arm. And when he presses on the spots, he hears this note. So he kind of goes, do, 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 you know, on his arm, literally. And that piece of music is like super, super powerful tune. And basically, if you hear it, you die.
Love it.
So he's got this ridiculous, and there's these two monks that kind of are the whole backstory, which takes about an hour, and that tells you where the tune came from. So there was this like this gross kind of baby that they had to bring up together. I'm one of the monks, and they had, they're Scottish as well, and they had to bring up this baby, and they took a vow of silence. I can't remember why, but they then like they immediately broke the vow and started talking to this baby anyway. And then they get punished by God, and God is this kind of like weird stick figure that my mum's a teacher, and they did this thing at school once to teach them about bones. So they made this stick man who was just like straight legs like this, and they made this really floppy man who was like a sleeping bag, and it was like, this is what you like without bones.
Nice.
Anyway, I got the this is what you like with bones guy and painted this little smile on him, and he was God. And he punishes them, and he kills the baby who's like grown up by now. And then the monks hate each other, and then they're kind of pulling the strings behind this like magic song. And then there's loads of songs in it, so they have to go and get something from the Horse of Truth, which is
obviously.
I think he has to get his axe. And it was back in the day when you had those big plastic horse heads, and I found one when I was in Japan, and I thought it was the funniest thing I've ever seen. And it's just this my friend of mine who's just naked but with his head on. He was the Horse of Truth, and Mason has to like kill him. He has to trick him, but it's all done in song as well. So it's like this riddle that happens in the song. And anyway, basically, it's like at the end he gets chased into a church, and by this point there's also another like a good piece of music that's been introduced to him, and the police are all surrounding it, and it's all being televised. And he goes into the church, and on the organ. You think he's probably going to play this music that's going to save everyone, but he plays the bad one.
Whoa.
And everyone dies.
Ba, ba, ba.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
That's the abridged version.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, that's mad. What? So... Yeah, I mean, A, give the people what they want. Clearly, they want to release Man Alone.
I think I might get cancelled now. There's some interesting stuff happening.
Oh, even more intrigued now. How did you, I mean, like, were you doing a lot of, because you do a lot of the band's videos. I know that you've been working with other people now, but historically, like, has that always been sort of film and cinema? Has that always been a big part of your life as well?
Yeah, I think doing something like Man Alone definitely set me up in a good way to... make music videos. So we started making our first video before we before we were really a proper band, and we just went from there. The Photoshop Hanson video, and that really helped us get signed, and that really helped make us attractive to labels, because they weren't like, what are we going to do with this band? They were like, oh, this is what they do. This is what they sound like. Yeah, that was streamlined the whole thing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's such a, going back to the Odyssey of Man Alone, that is such a wildly ambitious thing to do.
Well, I'd made a couple before it, so we the first one I ever made, we went to Orkney, just, it probably was around this time, we went to Orkney on a lad's holiday, and someone had a video camera, and so it was 2002, or maybe even 2001. And we made this film called Attack on New Yorkney, which was a sort of loosely followed Bin Laden getting up to stuff in Orkney. And I was this again Scottish.
Why like, always Scottish?
I don't know. Like sort of ghost kind of folk hero called Johnny Golspie, because there was a place there called Golspie that we'd gone past, and so it just sort of came. And it was just us dicking around. And then the next summer, we went and did the same thing again on the Isle of Jura, because these are like cheap places to go. And we made a film called While Jura Sleeping, which had was just about Bin Laden again. but he was hanging out with this guy who was sort of like a cat, sort of looked like a cat, basically. But that one was a bit more political. It had George Bush in and Tony Blair were in it.
Were they either of them the cat?
No, I was Bin Laden in that one, and a couple of other guys were in it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and then after that, I was like, right, I'm going to make an actual film. No one's going to stop me. So I just did. I just wrote a film and made it.
Amazing.
But it was I don't remember it taking that long as well. It was just because there was no like do a second take or anything like that. It was just like, this is the script, learn it just before you do it, film it with one camera, the sound is coming in through the camera's mic, like it was totally shit, but I just didn't care. It was just like, I'm gonna do this thing, doing it now, it's done. And actually I made another one after it that I never finished, because the band took all my time.
What was the give us a little premise?
It was a bit less ridiculous.
Was it also about Bin Laden?
No. It was about a guy who steals someone else's voice with this like little thing that he inserts in his neck and does all these recordings of him. And it was a bit like Perfume, but it wasn't smell, it was sound, because I thought Perfume was brilliant. And it starred Jeremy from the band and the guy from Man Alone. But that was never finished.
Maybe this.
And I was a record producer called Rogan Josh in that one. And I have big dreads, white dreads, blonde dreads.
I was going to say, maybe this is the lost relic that you should finish, but maybe it's fine.
No, it was fine. Well, it was braids. It was like Axl Rose sort of hair.
Oh.
Yeah. It was awful. I mean, I was meant to be ridiculous. Okay. I had a massive tash and stuff.
Beautiful.
I was
beautiful
called Rogan Josh.
Yeah. So... at this time, clearly a very creative man, doing lots of very creative things, some of which are in the object that you have brought for us today. If you would like to show the room the thing that you have brought.
So it's a box. It says, do not open or move this box without contacting Jonathan. It contains backup DVDs of my life's work up to this point. I will be biblically pissed off if you ignore this notice. So recently my dad sent me a load of stuff because he was clearing out a room, and this was among it. So when you said bring an object, this just jumped out.
The thing that should be pointed out is that Do Not Open has got droplets of hand-drawn blood on it.
So does Biblically Pissed Off. And my life's work.
What's in the box?
It's not as interesting as it sounds. It's quite realistically is that. So here's a Ooh. DAT tape of an EP I made with a band called Xenomorph. that me and my friend Jono made. Here's another version of the Xenomorph album, which was called The Apocalyptic Clonk, which is a quote from Bottom when they're getting burgled in Bottom. They hear the burglars downstairs, and Richie says, what was that apocalyptic clonk? this is a backup DVD of loads of stuff, loads of music I made, loads of really quite stupid music, most of it, but I was deadly serious that this should never, you know, leave my sight. This was like all the sounds that I would use, so drum sounds and samples and things like that. Oh, there's two in there. This is the same thing as the first one again. This is like a music program with loads more stuff. Basically, it's me deadly serious at what, 15 or 16, that this is my life's work. And to put it in a box like this, I just thought it said a lot about the guy I was.
The very, very earnest.
Yeah.
Biblically earnest, yeah. Boy that you are.
And everyone ignored it anyway. When I found it again years later, it had been opened because it was all sellotape closed and everything.
Rude. Yeah. The stuff that was in there, so this was like early music, like solo stuff.
Yeah, so
there's
stuff that goes back to like 1991.
Okay, what did you sound like in that time? Well, I mean, we've got a clip to come,
like,
which is
7 years old. Oh, yeah. No, that's 2001, what you're talking about. No, this is 91, so I was like 7, I think, or 6 or something. And I would make songs on the Casio keyboard and record them. And there is one where I'm not singing, but I just start shouting like, "Welcome to Krubs Tape." But the stupid thing is, it wasn't like a track that's overlaid, it was just instead of the music. So the music's going along and then "Hi there!" starts. Yeah. And then I would make music with really, really early software. I had a demo of something so you couldn't save. And I would just make the track that day and record it to tape and then got to close the computer down and it's gone, kind of thing. So I had hundreds and hundreds of those, and then it was slowly improved. But I was deadly serious about it all. And then high school, it got much more advanced. We would have these little mini disc players recording things, 4 tracks. And me and my friend Don would, we would go, basically every lunchtime, we would go to these little rooms that we'd found where they teach like trumpet and stuff. But they were empty most of the week. And we would just go there and record every lunchtime. Like, we used to get quite a lot of shit at school from people because we were alternative, and this was kind of a bit of a bolt hole we knew we could go to where we wouldn't get punched. And we would take these mini disc recorders there and just play guitars and drums and everything every day. And most of it was just funny and stupid. This you're talking about the Elliot track.
So I feel like we can't
definitely
even
need some backstory.
Yeah, there's a track that we're going to play very soon.
Yeah,
which is, so normally when we ask people to bring in a song from their youth, they pick, like, you know, one of the first songs that they heard, like a really formative memory from, like, you know, something that got them into music or made them start a band. Jonathan has brought in his own composition, which is just one of the best things that I've ever heard in my life. But I feel like before we unleash this thing, I would like to build us up to this point.
It definitely needs some explaining.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we did when we were studying music at GCSE was watch E.T. And study the music about it. And me and my friend Don recorded maybe 4 or 5 songs about E.T. in the aftermath of this, probably in the same 2 or 3 days, because we used to pump it out. And this was... there's a scene in E.T. where Elliot, the boy, is talking. And let me just get this right, the right way around. And he says... He's ranting about something, and then E.T., for the first time, goes, "Elliot." And then Elliot goes, "What?" And then he goes, "Elliot." And then he goes, "You can talk," in this really high voice. Not the kind of thing you'd write 4 or 5 songs about, right? But this is maybe the third one we did, and it's sort of recreating that scene. And then there's like a rap about the film and what happened in it. But obviously it's all done in like Elliot's high voice because we thought that that was funny. It doesn't make much sense, but I've given you the best amount of setup I can really for it.
Ready? Welcome to the greatest piece of music you will hear in 2024.
All right, Mike, I'll show you, but you've got to swear on the most excellent promise. promise you can not to tell anyone.
All right, I swear.
Elliot.
Oh, my God.
Elliot.
You're killing him, E.T. Games, you replace my dad. I'd like to thank him for the fun we had. We made a bond when he touched my hand. So back in 83, we formed a band.
Thanks.
Beautiful.
First question, why wasn't that the first Everything single?
A good one. We'd probably get sued.
So when you were digging back trying to find these things, are they tracks that like you go back to, like, do you still have all of these?
Yeah, I still have everything that's in there. I still have on my current like laptop.
Great.
In a folder called
Love
Rudyard
it.
Kipling.
Okay.
That's never changed. It says Rudyard Kipling on those DVDs in there, and that's never changed. I've always kept it. I've always transferred it to every computer. Like, it's important. I don't even have like Man Alive, but I have like gotta carry this shit around. Gotta carry 12 versions of E.T. came to replace my dad.
Why was E.T. the focus?
It was just the thing that we'd seen recently. We did it with Titanic. We did it with loads of things.
Oh, wait a minute. So there's like an entire...
Yeah. Whatever we were studying or talking about or found funny. So we found on one of these mini discs, we found this song by this someone else in the year below us called Nathan. And it was this really lame song. What was it called? I can't even remember. And we used to listen to it loads and thought it was hilarious. And so we started to cover it, and then we started to do different types of covers of it. And in the end, we had about 40 versions of Nathan's song, and he had no idea. And then I made a website and started to put them all on it. And we had all these like Photoshop pictures of Nathan as if he was a real artist. And he still didn't have any idea. I think he did find out in the end, but he was just like, I don't understand anything.
This is a very strange joke to me. Also, this reminds me, when you're talking about websites, I feel like if we're talking about your forays as a youth, what I discovered is that Jonathan made a disruptive website called EdX Hell, going against the school grading system that was, I'm going to say, was that, I mean, like, you were on like The Guardian, the BBC. These are your first like articles.
Yeah.
Your first bits of press.
Yeah.
Were as a teenager getting sued by a school grading body.
Yeah.
Please explain.
In the early days of the internet. Yeah. So we would do, while we were studying things like E.T., we would go to the exam and then they would give us a completely different film to answer questions about, for example. And we totally screwed up our exams. We were the first year to do the AS levels, which are probably gone now. I don't know. And so I was just pissed off. And I dabbled with websites like the Nathan website. And I just decided to make... I don't even know what I was trying to do. I just remade the EdXL website as closely as I could. But I changed the EdXL. And then I took like the pictures of their staff, like their heads of whatever... And all I did was I collected together loads of articles about how terribly they were doing, and just took quotes out of them and just plopped them underneath each person. So it would just be like, head of whatever, this is a shambles, whatever. A bit better than that, but that's all it was. And then there was a page of like, this is what it's done, this is what they've done for me, like, what this is what they've done bad in terms of my exams, what about yours? And people would start to send me things in. It was just this huge complaint list about them. And then I was like, okay, fair enough. I don't know why I've done this. And then I just thought, you know what? Why do all this work if it's not going to go anywhere? And I emailed a copy of a link to the website to their head of marketing or whatever it was. And he absolutely shat himself. Because I'd always referred to it. I didn't say, like, my name's Jonathan. And I made the difference. Like, I said, like, we at edX Hell are, like, fed up and all this stuff. And it just seemed like maybe I was more than I was, basically. And this was very early in the days of internet. It was like 2001
like
or something.
WikiLeaks or something.
Yeah. And so they absolutely crapped themselves and like, this is libelous. And it wasn't libelous because it was just quotes, you know, that other people had made. And I sent back some stupid email like, oh, this is something, something. I can't remember what it was. And then before I knew it, the press just sort of knew about it. And like Private Eye printed it in their Bin Laden episode, whatever it was.
Full circle at last.
Yeah, and I went on Radio 4, was being interviewed about it. And funnily enough, in another part of the country, Jeremy heard that interview. And I hadn't met him yet. And he's like, who's this twat?
Oh my God.
and ended up with, we had to go, we didn't have to, but with the, it turned into a bit of a PR disaster for them, obviously. And they invited us down here to London to like meet them and like tell us why it was okay that they were crap and stuff like this. So me and my friend Al went down and did some interesting stuff while we were here and like tried to like, they were like, because they were like, how much were the train tickets so we can comp them for you? And we were like, oh, they were like 400 quid, mate. And they were like, well, have you got the tickets? Have you got a receipt? And we were like, no. And they were like, so how are you going to get back? We just had no idea what we were doing. I think we were 17. And this was like one of the first times we'd come to London. But I'm sure they got their photo of me shaking his hand, whatever it was they needed. And by that point, I kind of lost interest in it. And I would still get all these emails from people going, they fucked this up and this, can't you help us with this? Because they thought I was a thing. And I was like, this is just me dicking about and like making websites about kids at school and stuff. I made one called Apocalypse Gnome around the same time that was just like garden gnomes being destroyed in different ways. That's the kind of level of mentality I had. Like, I made edX Hell, I made Apocalypse Gnome. I sort of thought they were equally valid.
And they thought that you were some sort of like political renegade.
Yeah, because it was before you would have things like something would trend on Twitter or whatever, and everyone's angry about this. It was just like, whoa, what's this thing coming from the internet where everyone seems to be getting together? It was because I'd always said we and things like that. It gave the impression of being a movement rather than just me.
Clearly. Even from the start, you've known how to PR yourself.
A bit.
Okay, so we're going to take a little break and then go to the bar, do all that business, and we're going to come back and talk a bit about Mountain Head, wonderful album, play some videos, do all that kind of stuff. Hi. Hello. Thanks for staying. Now we move on to the Mountain Head section of the evening. Yeah. I should get rid of. I actually don't have a different screen to put up, so that will just have to stay here. Oh, wait a minute. No, we can put. There we go. That can be a still. Hey, there we go. Everyone's heard the album? Everyone's bought the album? Yeah, there we go. Okay, so we're preaching to the converted somewhat. However, isn't it nice to do a little preach sometimes about this record that you spend a lot of time on? So I guess for the uninitiated, Mountain Head, big concept to the album of the Mountain Head and the sort of very real world parallels. Give us a little sort of synopsis of where that came from.
Yeah, it's not as insane as some of the stuff we've been talking about, I guess. it was trying to think of a big symbol that would say what I wanted to say without without being too obvious, but without but by being also really obvious as well at the same time. Just rather than saying this is the thing, it's just kind of here is something to represent it. I find myself doing this a lot when I talk about this album. A big mountain is like an obvious symbol, and the idea of everybody has to keep building it was something I wanted from the start. This sort of Sisyphean task that can't ever be completed and seemingly pointless. But also, as soon as I thought about it a bit more, I was like, well, how do they make it? What's the mechanism that they're using? They must get this material from somewhere. And I thought, well, they have to dig a hole. And this idea of having a sort of inverted mountain that goes into the dark and the big mountain that everyone's trying to make, suddenly I was like, that's all I need. That's honestly, that's good enough for me. And I can hang everything I want around that. I can build this world without trying to make it too narrative filled or too detailed. It was like, this is a strong enough idea of just, there's a mountain, we must build it, and everyone has to live in a hole, the end. And I was like, this is all I need. So yeah, and obviously it did become a bit more elaborated on, but not that much, and it just felt like a good framework and a good sort of simple metaphor for capitalism, or for like endless expansion, with this slightly absurd nature of what I'm describing, but I liked how it was sort of mirroring what reality is.
And it's sort of like the everything pyramid scheme in
we have mentioned pyramid schemes in the in some of the promotional stuff we did, in the letter that we sent out.
Yeah, that you've encouraged people to then send out themselves.
Well,
and then
I liked the idea that of trying to sell something, which is all about the fact that there's this world where people are trying to sell this thing that's sort of pointless. And there's obviously, we've come up against that loads in the trying to promote a sort of anti-capitalist thing, but that's really all part and parcel of talking about this stuff, is that you kind of first you have to accept that you're in it and you're not going to get out of it, and you're not really going to change anything, but you can talk about it. Yes. And that seems to be quite difficult for people to do sometimes, I think.
Yeah, I think like there's a sort of like all of the world that you're talking about, obviously it's very rooted in reality, but there's also these sort of like slightly sci-fi dystopian things. Like, is that, I mean, if we're kind of rooting this back to childhood and all this kind of stuff, like, were you always someone that was interested in these sort of like sci-fi kind of other worlds?
Yeah, to some extent. I think if you go too far down that road when in something like a band, then you just lose people and you sort of
then
lose
your muse.
Well, you're Muse. You are Muse. They're a really good example, because there was a time when they could have maybe not... They are. They're a really good band, but I think if they had stayed on the other side of that stuff, they'd probably be a great band, you know? There is always the Muse, like, tug of, like, well, we could. But I think keeping stuff in reality is necessary. And you can... I say loads of absolutely ridiculous stuff without having to be Muse, because reality is completely ridiculous. And if you set everything in an alternate reality, or you're just talking about spaceships or whatever they talk about, then you're losing the sort of humanity of it.
Yes, no shade to Muse, great band.
No, I love Muse.
But you're saying with this album, obviously kind of with previous ones, like the last record, you were kind of experimenting with AI and things like that. This one you've sort of said was you doing a sort of back to basics in your version of back to basics, you know, kind of going, playing in a room, doing stuff in a slightly kind of, you're shaking your head. Is
well,
that?
Well, I'm just smiling because we
is that just the press line? What's the reality?
It kind of is. Like, the reality is we didn't play any songs in the same room until just before we did the promotion the other week when we were on doing records.
Tell us the real truth then.
The real truth is me or Alex will make a demo of a song and then send it to each other a couple of times, and he might add something or take something away, or I might sing over something he's done, etc. and then we'll send it to the other guys. Or sometimes this all happens at the start. I'll just send something to the WhatsApp group and go, check this out. And then everyone will get some feedback and say, hey, I like this one, or maybe we should do it a bit faster or whatever. And then Alex and I will work on that. And then we go, what about this? What about this? And then we get closer and closer to the dates we're going to go to the studio. And Michael start learning the drum parts in his garden shed, and Jez will start playing the bass line at home, and then we'll get to the studio and Michael record the drum parts that he's already learnt, and then Jez will play the bass. And this is to the demo that's already been made a few weeks ago, and then I'll sing on it, and then Alex takes all of that away, plays the guitars on it at home, adds some synths or whatever. We do the mixing process, the mastering process, all that stuff, which takes forever. And then the record comes out, and we still haven't even played some of those songs in the same room. And it's been like that for three albums now. Since the pandemic, that's how we make albums now. So when we go on tour next week, we've never played some of those songs live. We've never even played them, like, not live. We've never even played them in our own, like, rehearsal studio.
What's the sort of, if this kind of, you know... What I was calling Back to Basics come from somewhere, was that from a different
I think
sort
we say
of...
that every time we make a record.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I don't know if this was Back to Basics or not. It was, I think what we did on this one and the last one was that we tried to write quite quick rather than writing something and then like poring over it for months and kind of like kneeling out the lyric and all this stuff. It was just like, write a song this afternoon, verse chorus, if you've got that and a good lyric, then that's done. Don't try and deal with it. Like, just don't try and come back and go, actually, why don't we do this? And you just kind of go, no, that's how I felt on that day, and I'm going to do this today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess that's not Back to Basics, but it's more like shooting from the hip sort of thing.
Okay.
There's much less like deliberation. It's all like, does this feel good? Do you feel an emotion? Let's record it. Whereas in the past, we would really go back and forth and change everything and keep hacking at the same stone until we'd made a sculpture. And this is just like, is it a cool sculpture when it fell out or not, kind of thing.
More importantly, what else do you talk about on the Everything Everything WhatsApp group?
That will never see the light of day.
No, that's
I
it.
I mean, anything you can imagine, but yeah, it's... There's quite a lot of... There's the background is like a custom background, and it's just Clarkson with this huge joint. So every conversation I've had in the last like 6 years about the band has been with Clarkson smoking a joint in the background.
It's like when everyone had the Zoom backgrounds.
Yeah.
And like the... Yeah, okay, perfect. I'd love it if I did a Zoom with you and it just had Clarkson with the Zoom.
Oh,
my
current Zoom is a... Oh, I can't remember. I think it's a chef's hat I've got on at the moment, and a Winamp background, because it's a... Well, we loved Winamp.
What Winamp?
Yeah, it was
Am
like
I
a
the
music,
only person that doesn't know what that
it's
is?
Like a, it was like a MP3 player that you could customize. It was really nerdy in like 2000.
Okay. I hadn't got nerd from you before, so
no.
That... So we're going to play a few videos dotted around. These videos were all shot in the same day, I believe, and we're going to talk about them after.
Yep.
But the first one is, I figured, let's go from the top of this album campaign. So the first track that you put out. Many, 30,000 days, I sent you the image of a little yes, yellow so face. All of the videos, of which we are hopefully going to play a couple more if I can work out how to use the laptop. They were all shot in the same day. Where are we here?
In Wales.
In Wales. I mean, like, what a nuts place to have found. Like, what was that? Like, how did you find this place? What was the idea for the place that you wanted to find?
We wanted a mountain. We wanted a cave. We wanted a beach and a forest. And we knew we were going to do something at night as well. And this fit all the criteria. It was all within a sort of radius, small one.
Yeah, so you were small. I mean, when you say small, pretty vast and small.
Yeah, so that was the morning. There was a storm coming in, a big storm with a name. It was going to be a big one. And there was lots of warnings. It was going to arrive at 11. And there was slate warnings about slates blowing off houses.
Oh, my God.
And we went to a slate mine. And we knew we had until 11 o'clock, basically, before we would die. So that's why you can see in the shot where it doesn't really cut and there's like spit on the lens. That was the very last one we did because the wind was coming and our hair was starting to go. And we were like, we've got one more shot and we're going to have to run out of here. So that adds a certain drama to it.
Yeah, an element of near treachery.
Yeah.
Yeah. I sort of feel like whenever people think of like making a music video, it's like, oh, what a glamorous thing to do. Make a music video, get your hair done, get your outfit done. What's the reality of doing a shoot like this?
Well, it was us and one cameraman and one other guy helping. And I got these judo outfits and I dyed them in my washing machine yellow. And I actually made some purple ones as well and some brown ones. And originally we were going to have the yellow ones were like the priests and they were like above the purple ones. And then the brown ones were at the bottom, like workers or something. But I only had enough judo outfits and dye to make four yellows. And I dyed the yellow ones twice, by the way. They went through the washing machine twice, each of them, on 3-hour washes. And then... So we had this situation where we had these four yellows and we had these two purples and two browns, and it was like, what? Are two of us going to be like servants to the other two or whatever? So on the day, we just were like, no, let's keep it just yellow. It's like more memorable if we just wear yellow for all of these.
Also, maybe a dodgy band dynamic if you have to work out who are the two servants.
It was too much. It was too much like lore to have like, to have hierarchy and stuff like that. It just didn't work. And it went with the yellow hair and stuff. So, yeah, we drove out of this. We rented this place in this little Welsh town and right next door to this house that had Hell's Angels in. And they'd, like, blacked out all the windows and they had all these skulls everywhere. And we were like, what the hell's this?
You were just like, I'm home in my dad's shed.
Well, no, they were like human. Well, actually, he does have a human skull, thinking about it. And a knee bone, actually, a kneecap. So... yeah, we thought we were going to be in for a bad time with these guys, but they were obviously really nice, because why wouldn't they be? So we left there, we came straight here to do this one, and then we went from here to do the climbing up the mountain one, which is, well, a big hill. I wanted a mountain, but it was
That's
quite
hard. That's
the next
hard one we're
going to
play.
Okay.
Are you coming outside? I can make it a business. I can sell you
I feel like you were about to tell a story about walking up the mountain before we then played you walking up the mountain.
No, not really. We had this, we had a camper van that was Kit's mum and dad's, and it was just like this old sort of stinky one we were in, and we just parked on the side of the motorway for ages, and then we just climbed up a few times. There was actually loads more we shot for that that would have made it a bit more like a video, but...
How like steep and high are we talking?
Well... I don't know. I didn't have a protractor.
Tell me exactly the geographical...
Like a 10-minute walk. But we had this drone going up and down, and then it was like we'd call each other and he'd say, right, lie down, and then we'd all lie down. And we had... it was cut together a bit more like a video, but we wanted to try and make this less like a video so that there's this weird thing where you put a single out, then you put out a track that isn't really a single, and you're supposed to sort of not... big it up and all this stuff. And then, so it was like I had this video ready to go, and then the label were like, no, we've got to make a more of a visualizer.
Yeah, and, make it less.
And I was like, but that's not as good. it's boring. So, but I don't know, that's what we had to do.
I thought it looked good.
Yeah, I mean,
I
sure.
Also, you mentioned Kit there. So Kit Monteith,
yeah,
who directed all of these, who plays with Foles a lot, does a lot of video stuff. He's someone that's done videos with you before.
Yeah, right back to, I think Night of the Long Knives Kit did with us.
Yeah.
Maybe even further back than that, I can't remember. But he's always sort of there to call, and he'll always do stuff. We want to make a video. We want to go to Wales for, a weekend.
We really want to go.
Shoot five
and,
videos.
Yeah. Get caught in a slate storm.
Exactly, yeah. He's a cool person he just says, yeah, okay. He brings his camera and we just do it.
Yeah, like how sort of, as someone that's done a lot of video stuff themselves, like what do you kind of look for in someone that you're working with? Is it hard to relinquish that control?
Well, I mean, we sort of directed them together kind of thing, and I edited them, so it's not entirely...
You dyed the judo suits.
I directed you those suits. I mean, I edited Cold Reactor, and we—I mean, I directed them all with Kit, basically. But we've sort of said that Kit did it, so that it doesn't seem like Neil Breen's sort of vibe. And obviously, he is a great director, and he did have loads of input on this as well. But yeah, I guess you just look for somebody who's up for stuff, somebody who can, who's adaptable, really. Somebody you can say, we want to do this insane thing, we don't have any money for it, or there's no realistic way of getting it done. Let's just try and do it. And he'll say, yeah, okay.
Yeah. What's, from all of your videos past, are there any particularly memorable ones that you kind of look back on, either thinking like, that was a fucking ridiculous idea?
We spent an awful lot of money on the regret video. It's quite a good video, but the snake costs a lot of money and just stuff like this.
For those that aren't aware, please explain about the snake.
Oh, this is a shot where there's just some guy has a snake. That's all it is. But there was a video made for Schooling back at the start of our big of our major label career. It was actually the first single was Schooling, and I, because I was, I wanted like some kind of prehistoric thing. The idea was to get to make a mammoth out of sand and fill it with dynamite. I guess you can see where this is going.
I know a guy who's got a recipe for that.
Yeah. So. And the video, which was actually made, was this guy, a sand sculptor, like digging up sand in like slow-mo and beautifully making this salmon? Mammoth. and then at the end of the video, it blows up. It literally explodes. And he made it, and the video was made. And then at the end, they pressed the thing. So this was made while we were abroad. We couldn't be there because we were promoting Man Alive. And it just sort of went, just sort of like its head just sort of like went like this. They didn't put enough explosives in it, which I could have told them about probably. And we just saw it back and we were like, this cost like 15 grand. And it was like the most money we've ever spent on anything. Like all our videos had cost like 10 pence before that. And we were like, well, this is shit, we can't do this. And then someone made an animated thing for us in like 2 days flat. And we put that out. We're like, here we are, guys, after all this history of making videos. And the first thing we actually put out was this two-minute thing that someone had made, which is fine, but it was kind of annoying. And anyway, I remember we were in Top Man or something. And the video came through. And I went up to Jeremy and he refused to watch it, and he still never watched it to this day, this video, because he'd heard what happens. He's like, nope, I'm not watching it, not watching it.
R.I.P. the sand salmon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know where that video is now, but I would like to see it again.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, you were talking about dyeing the jet, and like, I love the fact that you were like properly dyeing them yourself.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Hands on, do the stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not just going to appear. And we have to do that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, why do you, I'm sure this is a question that you've been asked loads over the years, but like, I think, you know, having that sort of aesthetic sensibility, you know, having kind of like a uniform and things that you wear together, like why does that sort of like element of building the world around the band feel so important?
I think it started because we couldn't really ever agree on what to wear. I mean, if you look at the very early pictures of us, we are just wearing any old shit from 2008 or whatever. And I don't know, I think it was a way to all just to take that out of the equation. It wasn't like Jeremy's the one that's going to wear this and Mike's going to be the one. It was just like, no, we all wear this. And then you can't tell us apart. Well, you can, but you know what I mean. It was more like the music was more important because we were kind of like workers that were supposedly indistinguishable from each other. And we thought that it would, well, I mean, we knew it would look cool as well, but we liked the idea that it was, we were just sort of trying to take ourselves out of the equation a bit. It didn't last long. Before long, there would be like, why don't we all wear this? And I'd be like, yeah, but I'm going to wear a cape. By like Get to Heaven, I was like completely rampantly like egotistical. And the other guys were like dutifully wearing their uniforms. But that was kind of what we were trying to do on Get to Heaven as well. I was supposed to kind of be a dictator. And then it sort of turned into the orange coat, which was a bit less insane. And now I'm back to wearing the same as the other guys. It was just kind of what we were trying to talk about at the time, I guess. Yeah. But we like Devo and Beastie Boys and anyone that wears a boiler suit or a uniform. We just think it's cool in the bands that we like.
Was the judo any specific reference?
Well, I wanted originally just to all be wearing like monk cowls for this album.
The Scottish monk comes back again.
Well, he was wearing one of those. Yeah. In fact, I asked my mum if she still had it for this, and then but Mike was saying no. People have done that a lot with rock bands and prog bands, and he said, "What do the Jedi wear under their big robes?" And I looked into it. I was like, "Well, they wear karate stuff." So I started to look. Okay, what can I get hold of? Judo. But I just don't want it to look like that, so I dyed it. And Sunshine Yellow seemed the obvious choice.
Beautiful. I did actually really enjoy how it was the sort of same yellow as the bits of flowers on the mountain.
Yeah, that's called colour grading.
Thank you. The last video we're going to do is Enter the Mirror. This is my favourite one. I feel like we go into a whole different world of concept here. Okay, right. Here we go. Enter the Mirror. Enter the Mirror. I find that quite a poignant shot.
They actually fly away in the next few seconds as well, because we obviously locked the camera off, and then the puppeteers were stood right there, and then we did a shot without them so that I could delete them. It's because there's no puppeteer there, obviously. They were stood right there. But then at the end of the shot, when we said cut, they were like, okay, and they just pulled their puppets away. Yeah. And I ended up accidentally with this shot. If you just press play now, you'll see that they suddenly just fly away. Well, they just fly away.
So sorry.
And I was like, that's actually an even nicer ending. Like, are they really alive kind of thing.
How was it? So you had proper puppeteers doing everything.
Yeah.
Did you have an idea of like the sort of sentiments that you wanted the puppets to
evoke? Yeah, I had wrote out this short script, and it was like he's looking for his friend, he can't find him, he sees a mirror, but it's just him, sees it again, it's not just him, it really is another puppet, they dance. That was kind of the whole script.
Beautiful, lovely. I think, like, I don't know, I guess as a band that have been sort of doing all of, you know, to still be kind of coming up with these sort of levels of concepts, to still be committing yourself to walking up a mountain, to nearly getting like killed in a slate storm, like 15 plus years into it, like that feels like, you know, there's still obviously a large level of like excitement going on with making these things. Like,
yeah, definitely.
Yeah. What do you sort of like when you come back into the everything fold, when, you know, all of you meet in a room, like what still feels like the sort of magic that's going on there?
I think we all love doing this thing. It's not like anyone's ever complained. I mean, when we asked Jeremy to bleach his hair, that was obviously...
Was he into
that
it?
That was quite a big deal for him. He's a hair guy. So yeah, Jeremy bleaching his hair, but you know, he did do it, and that shows, you know, his dedication. And he's got like frosted tips left now. But yeah, I think we all really enjoy it. I think if we stopped doing this kind of stuff, it would be really sad, even though, you know, two of us are dads, you know, it's not like we're still idiots. We're like sensible older people, but we're still basically messing around for our job, which is amazing.
Got to keep the spirit of young Jeremy making Man Alone.
Yeah.
During the 2 hour. Yeah. When's the everything, 2.25 hour?
You'd be surprised. There might be something eventually,
actually?
But it won't be that long. Christ.
Christ. Imagine how long an hour. Like,
I've started to work on something that is not really anything to do with everything, but it wouldn't be completely out of the question that it's related somehow.
Ooh. Is this an exclusive?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I've told you so little that go for it.
I guess to sort of, you know, we've been talking a lot about youth. We've been talking a lot about what you're doing now. Like, if you could go back to your sort of like, you know, teenage self that was making Elliot, that was making all of these mad things, like, what do you think the thing that you'd be sort of most proud of that's happened to you would be?
Well, I would just say that, like, I did start a band and it did well and things like this, which meant an awful lot to younger me. And yeah, I don't know, if that was taken away from me, it would probably mean a lot to me again. And it does mean a lot to me, but then it was like, I absolutely must do this thing. And that was from like 13 onwards. Like, I'm going to do this thing. I can remember when I was thinking about coming on this, I was thinking about my friend Paul. And I used to go to his place on a Friday quite often because he lived in Hexham and I was in this little village miles away. And I would stay over. And then on Saturday, he would always say, why don't you just stay today? And I would always say, no, I have to go home to do my tunes. On Sunday, I'd be like, no, I've got to go and work on my tunes, man. I've got to work on my tunes. And I remember one time he actually got really angry. And he was like, why have you always got to work on your fucking tunes? Your fucking shit tunes. And that makes it sound like he was more angry than he was. Like, why have you got to work on your fucking shit tunes? We're going to go out tonight. And I was like, I don't know. And I was like, I didn't know how to answer it. I knew I had to go and just like spend that day like making tunes on my computer. Yeah.
And now you've got 7 albums of tunes.
Yeah.
And it's all gone very well. Yeah. There we go. That feels like a nice place to sort of wind it up. Thank you so much, Jonathan Hicks.
That was Jonathan Hicks of Everything Everything talking us through his, quite frankly, dangerous exploits as a child. Lots of things there that we probably don't need to point out. Don't try that at home. Don't try making your own napalm, I think, is sort of a general life lesson to take through in general. But yes, big thanks to Jonathan. Big thanks to The Social. We will be returning there for more live podcasts in the coming months. But until then, we are now on season 2 of Before They Knew Better. That means you have 12 episodes of season 1 to go back and listen to. We also have the first episode of this season with the glorious C-Mat, which you should go and listen to also. While you're doing that, why not give us a like or a subscribe? That means that you'll get Before They Knew Better direct into your podcast inbox every Tuesday morning. The current issue of DIY Magazine is out now. It is our April issue with the wonderful Bob Villain on the cover. You've got Bob on the cover, the Bobs, both men called Bob, and you have the likes of Girl in Red, Lizzie McAlpine, the wonderful St. Vincent, all sorts of wonderful people propping up the inside of our April issue. Go give that a read, go give us a like and a subscribe, and we'll see you next Tuesday for the next episode of Before They Knew Better with DIY Magazine.